Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding.
And stress is known now as something that is not only cognitive, but it's behavioral. It's like physical. That is, I can see stress in another person. I can feel it in myself.
Mm-hmm.
And so our, you know, in some respects, it ties thinking and our bodies, our thoughts and our bodies together in a way that other concepts don't. And we know more now that racism causes stress, has stress effects, which affects your health.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt. You know, this goes into a lot of the study I've been doing in epigenetics. Mm-hmm. And there's a term you use also called racial microaggression.
Sure.
Does that is that the term kind of like for this incremental buildup and crescendo of racial stressful moments and just growing up black in America?
And actually, yes, it's partly that. I think Daryl Sue is the one who has been from Colombia, who's been the most profoundly speaking on these issues of microaggressions. He developed that word from I think it was authored by Leon Chestang, I believe, out of Harvard. But in a way, it's basically the kinds of insults that are intentional or unintentional that occur on a daily basis
mm-hmm.
of color in a context where their inferiority is part of the dialogues, part of the atmosphere. So mm-hmm. people will do things consciously or unconsciously to dismiss the humanity of people of color. And it so happens different people of color have different kinds of racial microaggressions. But the point that Sue is making, it has an effect on your well-being and your health because they build up over time.
Sure,
and
sure.
Because sometimes they're so small, you're not sure how to respond to them, right?
Absolutely.
And we think that...
And would you say it doesn't even have to be personal at you? It could be you viewing how someone is treating or what they're saying about someone else of color.
Absolutely. So we think of that as a stress full experience too, that I can have stress on what happens to me racially, but vicarious stress would be I'm stressed by what racially happened to someone else. And we've seen this. Margaret Beale Spencer did some work about in Atlanta where asking girls about how boys experience racism in classrooms. But some of us have siblings. There have been white friends who watch how their black friends, for example, have gone through harassments in ways that they didn't.
Margaret Beale Spencer,
even while they're actually in Atlanta, we're
asking girls about how boys experience
those
racism in
stressful.
But some of us have siblings. There have been white friends who watch how their black friends, for example, have gone through harassments in ways that they didn't, even while they're actually in the same spot and space, and those become vicariously stressful.
Unmuted.
Context of white supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, and for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Tuesday, May 9th, 2017. So I have been told we should be here tomorrow. In fact, we should be here every day for the remainder of the week. Pam should be back with us tomorrow. I think this will be her first time visiting with us for the 2017 calendar year. Always appreciate hearing her thoughts and views. In fact, I think the last time she was with us was the day after the November presidential election. So we'll be grand to check in with her again. Same time tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here on Thursday for Workplace Racism. Friday, for the 7th study session on the autobiography of the late Coretta Scott King, and of course every Saturday the compensatory call-in. So every day for the remainder of the week we will be broadcasting normal time. Our guest for this evening, one of our guests in the Missouri area, I encourage folks, I said, check. I think they've been having a lot of different events and what have you related to racism that you can check if you go to your local library, if you check out community colleges, or if they have major colleges, universities in your area, you can check. They'll have events, speakers, authors, all kinds of presentations dealing with racism. So you can go, you can get an opportunity to ask questions, find out more literature. Can be a great way to learn. One of our listeners in Missouri, he saw a presentation by our guest for the evening where they were talking about racism, white supremacy, racial literacy. He was able to ask some questions. He said, hey, you should invite him on the program to share some of his thoughts. I thought he had great information. He is the Constance Clayton Professor of Urban Education and the Professor of Africana Studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He constructs practical strategies to teach emotional and racial literacy skills to families and youth. We'll discuss his 2014 book, Promoting Racial Literacy in Schools, Differences That Make a Difference. Joining us live, our guest, Dr. Howard Stevenson. Dr. Stevenson, you with us, sir?
Yes, I am. Thank you very much.
Outstanding. Thank you so much for speaking with us this evening. For listeners, I'm sure some folks, this will be their first time hearing from you. Anything that you think would be important for them to know about who you are, the work that you do as we get started?
Probably that, you know, I'm the director of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative, and we've been doing training as well as research and program development around racial literacy with a focus on how do you navigate a racially stressful moment in less than 1 to 2 minutes. So we're really interested, particularly with Black and brown youth, how they are experiencing rejection in small spaces and face-to-face contact and in the moment. And those are the places we want to train people to regulate their emotions and to acknowledge the bias and to make better decisions, because we think that those are the places where our children are becoming victims of harassment as well as harm. So, and I also am director of Forward Promise, where we receive funding, and this is part of the Racial Empowerment Collaborative funding to become a philanthropic organization that gives out funds to organizations that serve boys and young men of color and their families. So, and finally, I'm the father of two boys, a 26-year-old and 12-year-old, and I'm very excited about who they are, and that constitutes most of my time outside of work.
Outstanding. For listeners who have not seen either a picture or video of you, you are a Black male, is that correct?
Yes, I am.
Right on. This program, Context of White Supremacy, I have unfortunately concluded that we are dominated by a global system of racism, white supremacy. I use those two terms, racism, white supremacy, as synonyms. I use the same definition for both terms. The definition I use is as follows: a global system of people who classify themselves as white and are dedicated to abusing and or subjugating everyone in the known universe whom they classify as not white. Do you think such a system exists? Do you think that definition is accurate?
I do, and I think I would add a little bit more about not just people who are white, but people who embrace whiteness, which is an ideology of white supremacy. The belief in things that represent whiteness are more superior, more important, superior on a lot of dimensions, and that other forms of identity or ideologies or faith are inferior against it. So I think of not only white people, I think it's of whiteness, who embodies the ideology of white supremacy through whiteness, that also carries out the actions and practices of white supremacy.
I see. I wanted to, one, compensate for our listener who recommended you. He said he was able to ask one question, but he had one other question that he was dying to get in and he didn't get a chance. You already mentioned that you're a father and how, you know, making sure that you're taking care of your black sons, that takes up, you know, a great deal of time and energy. And mm-hmm. he said that when he heard you speak, that you mentioned having to speak presumably with your younger child about the Trayvon Martin situation, the black male who was a teenager who was mm-hmm. shot and killed in Florida in 2012. He said you mentioned having to talk to your son about that, but you didn't go into any details about that conversation. Mm-hmm. Can you share a little bit with us?
Sure. And both of my sons, my oldest son is biracial, African-American and Filipino, and my youngest son is African-American. And I've been doing research on racial socialization for almost three decades, where the focus is, doesn't matter when parents talk to their kids about race. And we've learned a lot about how important it is. It's a protective factor. It's related to outcomes around academic achievement, emotional well-being. So it just so happened that for both of my sons at 8 years old, each of them got to talk about what you should do if you run into people who mistreat you because of the color of your skin, police officers and the like. And with my youngest son, we were folding clothes. And what I would have done if the gentleman was there, I have a video, I have audio taped the conversation. We were folding clothes, and on CNN, Trayvon's parents were on the television crying, and I was not prepared to have the conversation, but my youngest son, who talks all the time, had 1,000 questions. It was right after, it was August of 2013, right after the George Zimmerman trial, and the verdict, the parents at Trayvon were crying on the television, and my son was stunned by it, and he would not stop asking questions about not only Trayvon, but why George Zimmerman didn't get convicted. And so it forced me into a dialogue. Usually I'm prepared for these things, but this time it was an awkward process. And I shared that around the country, not only my attempts to try to explain to him at in the moment what all that was about, but also to hear from an eight-year-old boy's perspective what having to hear that, what having to deal with the sadness of a parent and struggle with the absurdity that someone would hunt down and shoot an unarmed boy, 17. Those were queries for him. And so we spent time processing that and how daddy felt about how he should protect himself should somebody chase him. But, you know, I wanted to tape it because of the way he processed his stuff. And what we've learned is not only do parents socialize kids around race, but children socialize parents around race.
Wow. Fascinating. I hope the listener who was in attendance, I hope they are satisfied. And I hope listeners appreciate that having Dr. Stevenson, with all of your expertise and years of rigorous research on this subject matter and writing books about this and articles and giving lectures all around the country on this topic and talking to children about racial literacy, that even you felt a little awkward. And, you know, having an 8-year-old ask you these questions, I think that speaks to how difficult this can be in trying to talk to your child or just trying to talk to younger people, period, about this subject matter. Mm-hmm. It is not the easiest thing. I think a lot of folks would prefer, you know, explaining calculus or trigonometry to have to talk yes. about racism. One more parenting issue, because this comes up at the very beginning of your book, Promoting Racial Literacy in Schools, Differences That Make a Difference. You start with an excerpt from a poem, Mommy Knew You When, and it reads, she read me the Riot Act every other day, not because I was the calamity, but so I wouldn't forget the riots about the civil rights. This mommy didn't make the bed every day or look for Best Buys. She wasn't like the mommies who held the pain back from their eyes. No slack she'd cut for me, no making a snack for after school mommy. Just flack about anything holding me back. She did the casting and the molding of our consequences, consciousness, to prevent unconscious hostage holding. She was blessed with the best that God could invest in the mind, and she was just as kind as other mommies, just not blind to the politics of her time. Why did you start promoting racial literacy in schools with this passage?
Well, part of the work that we've been doing for a long time now is that storytelling matters. And part of my story, so there's an African proverb, the lion story will never be known as long as the hunter is the one to tell it. And we encourage young boys and girls to do that, and families and parents. But my story includes my parents, mostly my mother, well, both of my parents, but my mother's way of dealing with racial rejection was to go right at people, and she would not tolerate it, and she didn't want us to tolerate it. And my brother, who's a pretty famous lawyer, in his work, you can see elements of that. He's a lawyer, and in a sense, he the same sort of fight against anybody's defining you in a moment. And so for me to talk about literacy is that is a call that she called for us to stand up for things that you saw were unfair to you. And your own feelings mattered in this regard. Your own perspective matters. Your vision of what was wrong is enough. You don't need anybody else to define whether it was wrong for you to have gone through that. You don't need a professor or an expert to tell you how you feel. You feel it. You see it. You can speak to it. And part of her being direct about here's what's really going on is that, you know, a belief that we could handle it, but we couldn't just idly sit by and swallow it. And that's really part of a literacy. It's about not only how you ponder these things and process them, but how you address them and speak to them and not tolerate them.
Importance of Black mothers, right on. When you use the term racial literacy, what do you mean?
Mm-hmm. Well, we define it as the ability to read, recast, and resolve a racially stressful encounter or moment. So part of the idea of reading, we think a lot of racism, one of the effects of racism, when they happen in face-to-face moments, whether it's on a street corner, classroom, in encounters with police, is that it brings an amount of stress, and that stress affects the body, it affects the mind, it affects the soul. And so the ability to read accurately, interpret a situation when a racial moment occurs, is a skill in of itself. Some people will go through a racial encounter and never define as racial because they're in denial, they're pretending, they want to make other people feel okay and comfortable instead of recognizing. That ability to see that this actually is a racial moment is a skill, and the ability to read that is part of racial literacy. If you can't see when a racial moment occurs, you cannot make good judgments or decisions to protect yourself or to stand up for yourself or to stand up for someone else or hold someone accountable. So interpretation of a moment accurately, that's a racial moment, is important. Second is recast. If you know your reading a moment is racial, you can also say, how well do you read your body and your reactions? Are you accurate in saying, look, I'm feeling stressed now on a scale of 1 to 10. I'm at an 8. And locating it, it's feeling in my right leg. It's twitching and shaking. And my self-talk is saying, this person thinks I'm inadequate or whatever. And all three of those things are part of interpreting and reading. And let's say I'm at an 8 or 9 stress level. Recasting means, can I reduce that level of stress from an 8 or 9 to a 5 or 6? Because 8 or 9, when you're stressed at that level, your brain goes on lockdown. You don't make good decisions. And if I have a strategy, whether it's prayer, mindfulness, meditation, whatever, to bring that down, I am going to be much more in control of the situation. So recasting is the second skill. And thirdly, resolve. How well do I resolve a racial situation where I've spoken my voice or held my voice that was a choice of mine as opposed to fear, and that I said what I wanted to say it's not an underreaction, pretending it didn't really bother me, or overreaction where I took everybody out and left the situation healthy, wealthy, and satisfied with my decision. So reading, recasting, and resolving a racially stressful moment is what we think of as racial literacy.
Wow. Two questions. My first question, when you say in this definition, being able to read, recast, and resolve a racially stressful situation, it's just been my experience. Sometimes people, everybody, white people, non-white people, in conversations on white supremacy, the language, it shifts from saying that this is an act of racism. And at least for me, I think that's important, because at the end of the day, when we talk about these stressfully racially encounters, I think it's most accurate to point out what's generally happening is someone classified as white practicing racism. It could be manifested in other ways, but generally that's the core of what we're talking about, Trayvon Martin, that sort of thing, why his parents were on television. If that's the case, I think it's more accurate to say what we're talking about is reading, recasting, and resolving an incident, an act of white supremacy racism, as opposed to a racially stressful encounter. Is that, am I making sense?
Yeah, except that one element of, I think, racism is whether you want to talk about it as a system, or do you want to talk about it as what is happening right in front of you right now. So I could look at the origin of how George Zimmerman got off as racism, you know, as a system, from the time he was arrested or not arrested, from the time that he was charged and not charged, the delay it took to even get him to a situation, the protection of the police. I mean, you could talk about that, but then you could talk about when my child is watching this, in this moment, he's affected by hearing this absurdity, and his body is taking a hit. His emotions are taking a hit. And so I do think you need to distinguish what are the effects in a particular moment. And that's what a lot of the research is showing. What happens in a minute or two is very different than how we think of systemic racism. That would be my distinction. And why reading is that you're really trying to say, what's the effect on me right now? And do I want to keep carrying this stuff? And I'd say, no, you got to be specific about what's going on right now.
I see. My second question, and one of our listeners, black mother in the Michigan area, she normally asks this question. I have to rob her of one of her potential questions. When we talk about being racially literate, being able to read, recast, and resolve these situations, and you said before, sometimes people, for a variety of reasons, they're in an instance where they're encountering, experiencing an act of white supremacy, but they deny it. To appease other people, or to keep them comfortable, or for whatever reason, or maybe they don't even understand. Maybe they just don't recognize that that's what's happening right now.
Right.
Who do you think has a higher level of quote-unquote racial literacy, meaning who do you think is most informed about what racism is, how it works? Do you think white people are more racially literate, or do you think non-white people are more racially literate?
I would say non-white people are more racially literate, but the detail of which I think even non-white people need to deal with the effects of white supremacy on their daily lives and health needs much more practice than we would naturally do. I don't think just because you happen to be a non-white person that you really know how to navigate the intensity of white supremacy. It's larger than we think. And the effects of it are much more intense than we actually have imagined, because we ourselves, we don't want to go through life thinking that we are living in a world where our humanity is somehow dehumanized, that is diminished. And I think so I would argue that, you know, James Baldwin always says that the mouse knows more about the cat than the cat knows about the mouse. And that's because in a power system where someone's trying to abuse you because you're different, you got to figure out the ways in which somebody's doing that to you. But I would say, yes, you're more literate, but much more practice and knowledge is necessary, I would argue.
Wow, that people can highlight that. I want to make sure I heard that metaphor correctly. You said James Baldwin used to say the mouse knows more about the cat than the cat about the mouse. James Baldwin, did I hear
it? Yes.
Correct? Okay. Yeah, folks can highlight that because I have a question about that coming up from something you wrote in Promoting Racial Literacy. I state mm-hmm. this consistently, and I think our black mom in Michigan, the number of times she's asked this question, I think like 95% of the folks who respond, white or non-white people, 95% might even be higher than that. They think that non-white people are more informed, have a higher level of racial literacy than white people. Mm-hmm. And I've stated consistently, I could be crazy, but I submit that white people are substantially more informed about racism, white supremacy, and even if I were to incorporate your metaphor, generally when I hear people talk, it's the cat toys with the mouse. The mouse does not toy with the cat. To me, if you're able to mess around with somebody like that, that to me suggests that you are way more informed. And even just looking at the definition for racial literacy, being able to read, recast, and resolve these moments, these instances where an act of racism has occurred, it just, to me, the evidence shows that generally speaking, white people, when any instance of racial stress or an act of racism comes up, it's been my experience that white people are way more informed about what's happening in those instances because many times they're the perpetrator. So they know exactly what they've done in those situations. And for the most part, the situations come out, the resolution comes out to the favor of the white person. They end up being the ones that are happy. It wasn't white people that were on television crying and talking about their children being in danger and feeling, you know, in fear as parents. That wasn't white people. And I generally don't see that to be the case. It's generally black people that are dissatisfied with how things have been resolved in these situations, mm-hmm. which to me strongly mm-hmm. suggests that it's black people. We are not well informed. We do not have a high level of racial literacy. Does that make sense?
I could see some of your point. I mean, in the idea, it sounds more like power to me. The idea that if you claim that, you know, abuse is a form of literacy, I would disagree with that. I mean, I think it's a statement of power. That is, I don't really care how you think. I don't care how you feel. And I'm going to make this work out better for me. It's not an issue of literacy. It's an issue of power and how I use and abuse that power vis-a-vis you, and that would be an active a set of acts of white supremacy for sure. But it is an interesting thought you raised that the outcome defines what somebody knows and what somebody can do. And I actually think that the element of intentionality is an interesting point. So it's an interesting point you're making.
Well, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, it's pushed me to consider, you know, in a different way, but I don't think that's literacy. I wouldn't call that a knowledge that somebody would abuse another person for the sake of survival or whatever reason.
I see. In my view, when people say that, power, racism, white supremacy is power. In fact, I use the phrase white power on a consistent basis because white power is why mm-hmm. no one was criminally convicted for the murder of Trayvon Martin. In my view, that's an accurate right. statement. White power explains right. the disparities in the school systems worldwide with regards to black people. There has to be a requisite knowledge to maintain white power for generations. I view these situations, in my view, knowledge is demonstrated. If black people were very informed about racism, white supremacy, we would not be the ones that consistently have a problem with it. I state consistently, logic tells me that we do not know enough. If we knew enough about this, then we would have solved this problem consistently. We still have a problem with it. We don't know enough. And it's white people that consistently they are able to, if you're able to abuse someone and maintain power over them, in my view, you have got more understanding, more knowledge about this than those folks. That just, to me, that makes logical sense. But I could be in error. Mm-hmm. On the cover of Promoting Racial Literacy in Schools, you have an elephant, and that pops up very early in the book when you get into your metaphors. Why is this elephant on the cover of the book?
Well, actually, I had used elephant because of the metaphor elephant in the room, but I wanted to be actually call the book If Elephants Could Talk, because I think the presence of people of color in any public, social, emotional, educational justice space causes tension. And I think there's a way in which elephant in the room, we all become that because of the threat that our presence often creates, or not creates, it's just that it ignites the threat in other people. And so part of the elephant statement was that in the classroom, this reality is unspoken and unaddressed, but it's huge. And I just wanted to spend time thinking about other metaphors about elephants and big and small spaces, the role of how you interpret what's an elephant, how some people interpret it accurately or not, and can you speak on it? The frame of it is one, an unspoken calamity right in front of you that nobody talks about.
I see. And you in the book, you say you have you confess an uneasy addiction in this area in terms of using metaphors to explain or to articulate your views on racism. Did I get that accurate? And just can you discuss that?
Yes.
Okay.
Only in the sense that sometimes I throw a lot of metaphors at people, and part of it comes out of a black cultural preaching tradition of using metaphor as a way to make a couple of points. But I try to, because it, in some respects, one way to break down folks' confusion about a thing is to bring analogies to help them walk through the scenario. So there are different stories or metaphors that I try to use sometimes to get across concepts that aren't easily spoken about or that people have a hard time believing. So even if you were to explain white supremacy, I mean, I think about the idea of even explaining why you would need to talk to your child about race. Some people fight that, both people of color and folks, white and non-white folks, struggle with the idea that talking to my child about how the world racially is divisive and uses and abuses power is a hard thing to get across. And sometimes metaphors help to bring people out of a sort of cluelessness or denial. And even, you know, supported by research, sometimes a metaphor around research can help people get a better sense of the thing. Sometimes it doesn't work, but part of it is that's the goal.
I see. When you talked about parents, sometimes using a metaphor can help parents understand why this is so important that they talk with their children about racism. Do you think some of that hesitancy is because of generations of racism and white terrorism, where black people were explicitly prohibited from talking about racism under penalty of death? Do you think that could be part of the motivation for not wanting to do this?
For some people, I think it is. Actually, I think it for more folks, it is not sure how to talk about it because of the shame and the trauma of it. That is, it's more likely that folks are traumatized by that history and don't want to be associated with it by bringing it back up again. In the same way, many of us have things that we're afraid bringing up or shamed by, that somehow by retelling them, we're taking on that shame. We're somehow admitting to our inferiority by having been the ones perpetrated the pun. And this we understand is trauma. You know, another scholar like Joy DeGree has been talking about this for years around slave, post-traumatic slave syndrome. But I would argue that by not facing those wounds, you don't get a chance to actually educate and deepen and understand the politics of white supremacy or racism, because those stories can help give you clues as to how the politics of white supremacy works. And so I think it's more trauma than it is, you know, having seen that and decided, you know, the best course of action is not to talk about it.
Hmm. I absolutely agree with the importance of sharing that information. Do you, I don't know your age, but just it seems like you might be a little bit older than I am. Do you have a sense that maybe 50 years ago, 75 years ago, that black people talked more to their children, like some of the older, we've had like Dick Gregory and some black people that are older who are in their 80s, late 70s, even some older than that. We've had a lot of them on the program, and they've said, some of them have said explicitly that their parents didn't have to tell them because it was so explicit and a matter of life or death that they knew by the time they were 10, you know, they had a PhD in racial literacy, where to sit down, which part of town you could go, like they knew. Do you think that has changed? Whereas, you know, there used to be more explicit dialogue to children and then that stopped. Or do you think it's been a kind of a continuum?
Great question. I actually think, because of the explicitness in the atmosphere and society, you're right. That people could figure out that what the rules were. But I don't think we did well about dealing with the emotional aspects of watching all that trauma. That is, I'm not sure I think we're better at now at saying, here's what it feels like to watch that all the time. And it's okay to talk about. And I think we need to do a lot more by interpreting these events that occur now, which you might argue are still just as explicit because of the age of social media. But we still don't know how to help young people navigate watching another story of a 15-year-old getting shot and or watching a video of someone getting shot. There's an emotional cost to that that requires much more conversation than even we have today. So it's a good question. I do think that we still struggle over airing this dirty laundry around these events. And our work tries to encourage much more conversation around to heal, to be more explicit about here's what we want you to do should someone treat you in a particular way. That's the direction of the future of racial socialization, in my view, that you instead of just when something happens, you start talking about it. You need to prepare ahead of time and be explicit and include how beautiful and wonderful and talented you are to counteract those other negative stereotype messages. I think by being silent, we often somehow protect ourselves to a degree, but we also can't stop the internalization of inferiority that happens when you're silent as well.
Great response. Context of white supremacy. Again, our guest, Dr. Howard Stevenson. Folks have questions you would like to ask, the number to dial 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. We have a significant number of black parents who listen to the program, and I have encouraged this for years. We have had children participate on the program of young children, Justice back when she was 10 years old, and really saying that this is an important way to work against racism, white supremacy, because your child, your little black boys, black girls, racism is going to be a problem for them. It already is. You need to go ahead and prepare them, you know, so that they can deal with this, so they won't be stunned. And we've had parents who said, hey, what's your suggestion if your child is called a nigger? And a lot of folks gave out suggestions. Some people said they didn't even have a suggestion, that they were kind of stumped when, you know, trying to think of what to tell their child. Have you talked with your child what to do if they're called a nigger?
Yes. And part of the feedback that I've been giving is to first, we have a strategy called calculate, locate, communicate. And that includes know what you're feeling and calculate on what level it is. Locate it somewhere in your body where you feel that feeling and try to relax that part of your body. And then thirdly, what self-talk is going on in your head when this occurs? And so in the process, we've been able to teach fifth graders to be very clear about where the effect of a microaggression, including called the N-word, affects them. And then once they get a sense of their own body and emotional regulation and thoughts, we practice what we call healthy racial comeback lines. So a healthy racial comeback line is a statement that you would make to protect yourself. That means you're standing up for yourself, and that what you're saying addresses the aggression that has come at you in a way that's not an underreaction, that is, you pretend it wasn't that big a deal, or an overreaction, where you just cuss the person out. Now, because cussing the person out may help for a little bit, but what you really wanted to say, if somebody calls you N-word, is that you don't appreciate the inferiority they've thrown at you. So you could have 100 ways, funny ways, sarcastic ways, to say it. But the key is you got to say it in a way that you will feel healthy and whole when you're done to address the aggression. So we practice with young people so many funny and different ways they come up with to do comeback lines. And they choose to say them or not, but they're at least prepared, if they choose to say them, how to stand up for themselves. A comeback line can then turn into more than a lie, but a way of thinking about how you will not tolerate when somebody dismisses you. And that you might say it differently to a teacher than you do a peer, but you at least walk away from a situation and say, I don't deserve that. I reject your rejection of me in this moment, and I will not swallow that inferiority because it's your problem, not mine. So if you get the psychological benefit, that's the goal we're going after.
I see. I think that's great, being able to identify how you're feeling at that moment, how much stress mm-hmm. you're experiencing at that moment, and then already having some lines. And that's one of the things that I've said before. Already have it's if it's going to be a question, if you're going to say anything at all, if you want them to however you want your child to respond. But just being able to practice some of those ahead of time and something that fits your child's personality that they're comfortable saying and that they, you know, this will be kind of my go-to line, your healthy racial response. I think, and just being able to practice some of those, that I think that's great. That way it'll be natural. And some parents have said that it's worked brilliantly. They've been kind of able to go over, kind of rehearse some of these scenarios, and their children have been able to do really well because they're not surprised. They expected this sort of thing, and they already knew what to do if this hand. I think you used the metaphor I've heard in some of your talks where you say it's just like with children, parents, if you tell your child, beware of strangers with candy, same thing. even if you never encounter one, you know what to do. Same thing. You teach them about racism and how to handle it. Bam, it happens. Oh, yeah, they told me what to do. Boom, boom, boom. This is my response, and I was at a stress level 6. Now I'm feeling pretty good. Like, great way to deal with things. We had a caller dial in with a question. The person who dialed in, last four digits. Oh, this is our retired firefighter. Retired firefighter, did you have a question for Dr. Howard Stevenson? Your line should be open, sir.
Greetings, everyone. Greetings to the guests.
Greetings.
Hello. Yes, sir. I appreciate what you are doing. And I know how important it is to be racially literate. That's how you phrased it?
Yes, literacy.
Mm-hmm. Okay. But my question is, if non-white people are more proficient in understanding racism, white supremacy, how could a group that is subject to the other group and they are more proficient literally on the subject matter? That's the question.
I don't believe that white people are more proficient in racial literacy. I don't consider the abuse of power and dehumanization of other people, brown and poor people, as a statement of literacy. I see that as simply a dehumanizing, a form of dehumanization. And so even if the outcomes are in their benefit, I would not think of that as being smart or literate or proficient in any kind of literacy except the literacy of abuse and dehumanization. And I think both spiritually, there's a cost to that. But maybe, Gus, you want to talk about your answer to that question.
Well, I based on how you're explaining it, I think I understand from your point of view based on how you explained it. But okay. It still provides the misunderstanding or not understanding in my mind on the idea of someone who is more proficiently literate on a subject matter, but yet they are subject to the people who aren't. Logically thinking, to me, that group must be, and when we're talking about the people who identify themselves as white, they are a tiny, tiny minority of people within the planet. And we're talking about the group that is subject to them is the overwhelmingly larger group of people. But yet for centuries, they are subject to that. It must be something that the lesser group, the smaller group is doing and have an understanding of in a very coy manner that the non-white group is in this case. Now, from my experiences,
Have a question coming, sir?
Well, that was my question. That was my question they originally asked. I was just doing the wrong thing and articulating on it. But that's all I had. I asked the question, and I got an answer.
Oh, okay. Right on. Please do not lollygag. Oh, the caller previously mentioned Mom in Detroit. Dialed in if you had a question for Dr. Stevenson. You should be with us, ma'am. Sorry, I stole your most popular question.
It's okay, Jeff. I have another question. Good evening to all the callers, to the guests. And my question, because you did answer the question, so I'll ask a different one. And actually, the previous the firefighter from Florida kind of touched what I was kind of getting ready to allude to, but who do you think, or rather, do you believe that white people are smarter than non-white people?
No, not at all.
And why do you say that?
Why would I say that?
Mm-hmm.
Because, I don't know, experiences that I've had in my own life, the history of racism in this country, the mediocrity of some people who've risen to power but don't have the competence or skill to get there or to do a good job in any level. You could talk about it from academia to a legal profession to court systems to health systems, that the level of mediocrity. It depends on what you mean by the word smart. Now, there are a lot of ways that I would challenge the definition of what is smart or intelligence, because there's many ways to think about intelligence. But I haven't found any evidence that they are. And I don't think the abuse of power or dehumanization of other people is an issue of intellect.
Okay. And then my last question is, what do you think, it will take for racism, white supremacy to end? And do you think it's the responsibility of white people or non-white people to end the system? And that's That's my question. I'll mute myself and listen to your answer.
Okay. Well, I think it's more complex than that. I don't think it, I think in some level we all had a view that the way of dealing with racial politics and racism was linear, that we could eventually, once we got to a place of integration, that eventually the doors would open. And I write about this in the book, that we had a very linear view that the more we got Black people in positions of authority, the first this, the first that, the first Black president, that then doors would open up because we would have challenged the myth of our inability to become the first or able to do what other people, what they have not been done, been doing for years and been able to do. So we never accounted for the backlash that even if you were able to do those positions and those jobs very well, that people really didn't care. We moved from a view of, are you smart enough? Can you do it? You can't do it. And then when you do it, then the rules change that we just don't care no more about whether you can do it. We think we're better than you. And so we'll use violence as a way to just recreate a world where we're on top. And so, you know, in a sense, we didn't plan for backlash where whether you were smart enough, nobody cared. Whether you were faster, nobody cared. Whether you could, you know, do the job better, nobody cared. I'm just going to take the job for me and mine. So I think the issue is not, is it going to be over? But I just think, what lens do you have? So some people, and I say this to people who send their kids to the richest schools in the country and those who send them to the most troubled schools in the country, that, you know, unfortunately, if you are in a place where there's a lot of sand, if you think it's a beach when it's a desert, then you're in big trouble. You're coming to this place with a bathing suit. You're not prepared. The fact that their racism could still be alive and well means that we're in a desert. But if you come prepared for the desert, you can still survive it. And I would argue that you can transcend it. But not if your lens is, I need to be at a beach or else I can't exist. And I would say, whether it's going to be over is secondary to the issue. I think the bigger issue is, how are you going to prepare for life if it doesn't ever go away? And we can't wait for that. That question is a future question around, to me, that's less relevant for how I get my child through tomorrow.
Did that answer your question, ma'am?
It did. Thank you for taking my...
okay.
Yep. No, thank you. Yep, I appreciate it. Thank you. I'm going to mute myself.
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you for the question.
Context of white supremacy. Did I hear that correctly, Dr. Stevenson, when you were answering her question and you said that a lot of Black people thought incorrectly that, you know, hey, if we get a first Black president or a first Black professor or CEO of this company, that, you know, hey, that will show white people that Black people are worthy of correct treatment and, you know, equality and all of that, and they will do correct by us, and we'll be able to move on up and do well in the country. And then when we got all that and continued to be victims of the system of white supremacy, it was, oh, wow, we were confused. We were wrong about thinking that if we just did these things, we would have solved this problem of racism. That's not it at all, that we had an incorrect way of thinking. Did I hear you correctly?
Correct.
Okay. To me, yeah, that suggests Black people not being very high on the racial literacy level test. That to me suggests black people not having a very high level of information. And in fact, I suspect, and we have a number of white people on the program for years. We've been on the program, we've been on the air almost a decade, where they did not seem to have that same level of confusion, where white people, 60s, 70s, 50s, 2000s, where they never had that thinking that, oh, yeah, if a black person gets a car or if a black person gets a whole lot of money or anything else, it's just a nigger with a car. It's a nigger with a lot of money. Like, yeah. It seems like that's always the thinking that they had, which to me just, again, I mean, I just because I think this is so huge, I've said this for years, I think this is one of the big reasons why we are continuing to have this problem, thinking, suggesting that white people are poorly informed or white people are ignorant about racism, and equally thinking that black people are well informed about this. That's not the case at all. And like I said earlier, about 95% of the people that I talk to, that's the standard predictable response, that white people are ignorant about racism, black people are the experts on racism. And I think that's, it's the exact opposite. The experts are all white. If we're talking about the expert, and to me, it's as simple, going back to a metaphor, it's as simple as if we're talking about who's the best at basketball, we just get a ball, we go out and we look at the scoreboard. That's it. If we're talking about who's the best at chemistry, we go get the chemistry exam, we take the test and we look at the score. I look at the same thing with racism. Anytime there's a problem with racism, I look at who comes out disgruntled about things. Every time around the world, without exception, it's black people. I cannot look at that and say, oh, yeah, black people are the experts on racism if they're always the ones who have a problem with it. That just does not make logical sense. I wouldn't accept that if we were talking about cars. If you told me you were an expert on automobiles, and every time I see your car is broke down, I would start to scratch my head about how much expertise you have about vehicles.
Right.
Context, white supremacy. Making sure I get one of my other questions I wanted to get in, I thought was equally important. You also said that when we talk about, I guess, in classroom settings in particular, and I was just writing about this for Atlanta Black Star, my second question, but you talked about in classroom settings how sometimes white educators, they might have unconscious fear of black people, and that might unknowingly influence how they are communicating with, treating black people that they're around. And that promoting racial literacy, if we can, you know, talk about this and maybe develop some strategies so that they can be more aware of the white person, they can be more aware of this and then mitigate, you know, be aware of this when they're talking to and having contact with black people. You were saying that in these sort of situations that it's not about blaming that white person who has maybe unconscious fears of a black person. It's not about blaming them. It's just about understanding that You do have these fears. You do have these issues. Let's address them and come up with better strategies. Is that did I hear you correctly?
Only in some cases. Mm-hmm. I think the issue is there are some people who blatantly don't care about other black people or brown people, and they are intending to harm them without any unconscious matter whatsoever. It's very conscious, and I would say they don't apply to that situation. And the issue of what's unconscious is irrelevant. So somebody who's being violent towards you and thinks because you're black or brown doesn't apply to that. And I would also say the goal is not simply just to make somebody aware, because I think part of the goal is to hold you accountable because you're not doing your job correctly. So it's an incompetence when someone, whether they are conscious or unconscious, it still represents malpractice. So the idea that we need to still hold you accountable for malpractice, whether it's conscious or unconscious, is still very important. I could say, oh, great, I can see how you didn't get that what you were doing was unfairly biasing towards black and brown children. But then I still need to say, maybe you shouldn't be doing this job. That's another part of it, because you're not competent to do the teaching or do the protecting and serving. That's another element that I think wasn't in that example that I also need to make clearer to people as well when I speak speak like.
I see. At least in my view, it seems like that accountability piece that you talked about, I think that's critical in viewing this, you know, whether you're conscious, unconscious, that this is malpractice in terms of the impact that it's having, harmful impact that this has on black children. If we're talking about a classroom setting with racist educators, white educators,
yes.
I don't see the accountability piece. It seems like that often really predictably fails, where this happens and there is no accountability, where, you know, they just are allowed to continue with these practices. Do you see that?
Yes.
Do you see that changing? Do you see anything happening to where there is going to be some accountability?
No, I actually believe, like you're saying, that is an example of white supremacy, that you could be as incompetent, conscious or unconscious, and still keep your job and actually go out and do the same stupid stuff again. And I would argue that, you know, knowing that somebody unintentionally caused harm, we shouldn't be spending our energy on that person's struggle. That is, we should help them if that's possible and remediate. But you might say, maybe you're not ready to be in face-to-face encounter with children until you get better at this, until we see. And I think if you hired people with examples of, here's the kind of racial bias that we see going on in the classroom, let me see how you would handle this. You can get better judgment on competencies if you include in hiring and evaluation of performance what you expect to see. Now, in our world, in Racial Empowerment Cloud, we say we should expect to see affection, protection, correction, in the relationships between adult professionals and black and brown children. And if I don't see that, it's an issue of malpractice. Now, the question is, how much do I not see affection, protection, and correction going on with my child in the classroom, on the street corners? And obviously, the lack of accountability is a lesson for all families that, you know what? You know, we have to prepare a child for a world that won't be fair around giving you affection, protection, and correction. And that's part of the tragedy of being different. But I think the goal is still to hold people accountable and emotionally take care of our children and our families if we find them in that kind of situation, right, where they've done what everybody's expected them to do, they play by the rules, and then somebody decides we don't care about the rules anymore. So I don't have as much hope that accountability will change. But I think you still fight for it out of a sense of humanity and protection of your own. But I think you prepare people in case that fairness doesn't come.
I see. With regards to accountability, I just wrote an essay for Atlanta Black Star on white women teachers, and you, with the work that you do in the field of education, there are over, according to the Department of Education's 2016 statistics, there are sizably more than 2 million white female teachers in the public school system in the U.S. They account easily the majority of teachers in the public school system, unless I've been grossly misinformed. When we talk about what's called the school to prison pipeline, with the preponderance of white female teachers and even the legacy of racist white women frequently being at the center of allegations that resulted in lynchings and or whole towns, black residential areas being destroyed. Tulsa, Rosewood, very common allegations started with a white woman accusing a black person of something, often sexual. Is it accurate, do you think, to say that white women are squarely at the center of what it's called the school to prison pipeline for black children? White women teachers specifically.
I think that's a fair statement, as long as you judge who's very lousy at this and who is better at this. I have examples of white teachers, one in particular, which I write about in the book, I believe, who actually stood up on behalf of many of us in high school and we violated a long standing rule for which kind of play the senior play should be. It was either Hello Dolly or Oklahoma. Those are the only choices usually that you're going to see, and there are no black parts. And she decided to choose Raising the Sun as a senior school play. So I put this essay about her in a book by my colleagues, Dr. Allie Michael and Dr. Eddie Moore. They're writing a book about what white teachers should know about teaching black boys. And that should be coming out soon. But in it is a lot of feedback around that. But I think you need to judge what level of incompetence are these teachers doing so that we can that lead to that school to prison pipeline. And to be very direct about it, as well as who's not doing that.
Wow.
And, if you look back now, the people who were in that play, my brother played Walter in the play, in Lorraine Hansberry's play. I played Willie Bobo in the play. And it was like being in the center of your school's pedagogy. She took the heat of a lot of angry students and parents. She took that heat. And that's what you want from a teacher to do, right? That's what you want. And where she found the courage to do that, you know, is another story. And is she in the minority to do that? I would argue, yes, she is, as a white teacher. But there are some who do that and in a way deserve the props for making that stand and doing affection, protection, and correction to her professional demise.
Was she fired or did she get demoted to janitor?
No. Actually, she didn't. She just took the heat of rejection from parents. So she held her ground. She was that good and she was that outspoken, I would say. But I think in other cases, I'm thinking more of people do get fired for standing up on these issues.
Okay. Wow. There's so much. I have so many. I had so many responses while you were sharing there. I felt like I could do that in like slow motion as I was hearing each word come out in your response. So Lorraine mm-hmm. Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun that came out during the middle of the civil rights movement. And then we had Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. Is this the same Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. that's founder of the White Privilege Conference or a different Dr. Eddie Moore?
Absolutely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Dr.
Eddie Moore Jr., who's been a guest on this program more than once and who threatened to who made a veiled threat that he would enjoy punching Gus T in the nose, has been a guest on this
really?
Program. Oh, yeah. We do not have similar views on racism. We have different views on racism, white supremacy. And even I laughed because to hear that he's writing a book. And Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. To hear that he's writing a book on what white women need to know. It goes right back to what I said before about I said one of the main problems that I see with going about addressing white supremacy racism, the promotion of this idea that white people are ignorant. Even in your response, when we were talking about white women teachers being at the center of the school to prison pipeline, you used the term incompetence, again, suggesting that this is white female teacher ignorance that is producing this behavior in the classroom. And I'm saying emphatically, it's not ignorance. It's not incompetence. This is dedication to racism, white supremacy, and I think, in my view at least, using the terms ignorance or that they're just unaware, I think that just it drastically portrays, casts this problem incorrectly, and it really invests mm-hmm. white people with much more naivete, with much more innocence in this than they should be. I mean, in my view, it drastically obstructs being able to accurately view a problem. If we're saying that this is ignorance, and if we could just get Dr. Moore to write a book or to have a conference, get him to the White Privilege Conference, and that'll correct this problem, that'll take care of it. No, that's not it at all. They are dedicated yeah. to the system of white supremacy. And I've been to the White Privilege Conference and I told him they just go to these conferences, they get these books, and they just refine. So they get better at being able to use words to fool us into thinking, oh, yeah, this white person is down. They can advocate and go out. That was, as I was going through my slow-mo response to when you were answering the question, even hearing, because you started your response, you were talking about this white teacher who helped you all not do Oklahoma. You all got to do Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Stunt, deviating from the pattern. You conceded that this is not normal. This is not representative of what white teachers, white educators generally do. That, in my view, is a pattern where we start with white anomalies. This is not representative of typical white behavior. We should be starting with the general response that we see from white people, which is not this. I think that in of itself, it distorts getting an accurate view of white behavior. And again, just making an accurate assessment of the problem. If we're starting with anomalies and these outliers that are just not representative of usual white behavior. And even when I heard that response, I could see why white people would like Raisin in the Sun. That's a very popular play. It's been put on for many, many years. I think my favorite version of it has the late Ruby Dee and Sidney Poitier, but very popular film. They've redone it so many times. Felicia Rashad has been in it, and P. Diddy, and just goes on and on and on. I can see why white people would like that film, given its portrayal of kind of black degradation, and you basically have a black male who wastes all the family money and is drunk all the time, and their whole goal is to move out of this slum with white people who don't want them to be there. Like, that's, isn't that an accurate summation of the play?
Not the last part you just said, where white people don't want them to be there. Yeah, and I think the white folks around us weren't happy about that play at all. So part of the politics of that time, that white people be accepting of this kind of movie is only after the fact, after years of it being produced, yes. But at the time when it was started, and the part about what I think Hansberry is doing is talking about how black families navigate some of that racism. I think you could disagree that that's a different way of how you cope with racism, one you don't agree with, but I don't think it's true that it wasn't powerful in changing how white people think about what black people can do. So at a different point in time, you know, there's a lot of things we might reshift in, because where it's centered is in Chicago at a particular place where racial politics were different. But I mean, to your point, I agree with you that I think that the predominance of white teachers in schooling is a problem. But I don't agree with you that it's about innocence. And I don't think that the whole issue of accountability is still very important. And I tell the story about her because it made a difference in how we as a group of black youth in that school were empowered by that decision making. Now, the reality was we actually brought out black folks from the neighborhood to come watch the play. It sold out two or three times. So it was not just one time. It sold out for three times. And the issues of support of black folks in that community, a very rural Southern Delaware community, was generative. And it lasted, I would argue, for a very long time. So it's not just easily black and white, good or bad. But I still made the point and agreed with you in the beginning that the predominance of white teachers presents a problem when they don't really understand the dehumanization of black and brown children.
See?
Now, you can call it ignorance. You can call it unintentional or conscious or unconscious. I still think it's a problem. If you accidentally run over somebody with your car and you're the sweetest person in the world, you still get hit by the car. I think we need to focus on who got hit by the car, not whether the person was nice when they hit you. So that's not about innocence, in my view.
Thomas in New York, did you have a question for Dr. Stevenson? Thomas in New York, did you have a question, sir?
Well, I came in kind of late, but I just... my question is, does the guest think that there'll ever be a time when white people are going to stop practicing racism, white supremacy?
Do I think there'll be a time when white people will stop engaging in white supremacy? I don't. It's an interesting question. I don't think so. And I think that the issue, because it's an issue of power, can we make a dent in people changing how they mistreat black and brown people? Yes. And I think some of the work that looks at even at pre-K, these things going on, is helpful in that regard. But I wouldn't argue that it'll be over in a particular set of time, given the way that we've watched over the last 300 years white supremacy play itself out.
Okay. Now, my next question to you is, do you think that there are white people who are not racist?
Well, I think that there are, all of us are struggling with this issue of whiteness and white supremacy. I don't think just white people struggling with white supremacy.
I asked you, do you think that there is a white person who is not racist, not anyone else, just white people?
Do I think there are white people who are not racist? We would disagree on what is meant by who's a racist. I don't think, given the work on conscious, unconscious bias, I think very few are without, it's hard to not be racist, I would say. Very hard. I haven't seen it.
All right, so yeah, conscious and unconscious bias that you just talked about, which I don't know what that is. However, this conscious and unconscious bias that you're talking about, which it seems like anyone could be conscious or unconsciously biased. Can there be anyone other than a white person that can be a racist?
The way I would define racism is that you would carry on a belief, a system of whiteness that believes you are better than somebody else. And that you could carry that out.
You could name a group of people that could invoke a racist act on white people. Can you name that group?
As a system, no. But I would argue, in terms of how we treat each other, that still has an effect, an outcome that is powerful. We could argue back and forth, is it more powerful than an act of systemic racism? But I mean, I could give you some examples of how the effects of racism affect how we look at each other as black and brown people. And that even as black and brown people, we carry out some of that inferiority with each other. And that has consequences.
The act of racism that you're talking about, that we tend to divert negative effects on each other, who is provoking that act of racism?
I think over time, we could argue that the system of racism and white supremacy that has been historical for centuries produced that. And we could say that white people were the beginning of that, yes. And anybody else who participated in that system over those decades and centuries participated in producing that belief system that has led to where we are today and continues to be socialized with leadership that we see and hear that on the news every night. But it's more complex, in my view, to say that just because it began there, that we are not ourselves perpetuating it in different ways.
Okay. My last question, sir, is are you now or have you ever been in a relationship with a white woman?
I am not now, nor have I ever been in a relationship with a white woman. But I'm not against it. But I have not been in a relationship, and you know, in a sense, it's an interesting question.
Appreciate that, Thomas in New York. I think he said that was his last question. Dr. Stevenson, do you think the individuals classified as white, do you think it's relevant, the fact that they constitute a minority in the global population? The overwhelming number of people on the planet are classified as not white. Do you think their global minority status influences their practice of white supremacy racism?
Absolutely. I mean, you could argue that this is the work of Dr. Cress Welsing. I think her color confrontation theory makes a lot of sense psychologically, that if you are worried that your group is in a minority and you're going to get wiped out, I mean, you could explain a lot of the activity in our own country and around in Europe, this fear that we're going to be annihilated by intruders who are brown and who speak different languages. That is a reason to support white power and white supremacy. So we have to go extra uber in the rejection of difference, because we could get wiped out. And I think that would be the sense of threat that I see in the relationships on the street corners and in between police and youth, between teachers and youth. That is that sense of threat is where I would argue happens in face-to-face contact as much as it happens in these systemic ways.
Wow. When you present about racial literacy, and sometimes white people are present in these issues in terms of white people having fear of black people or feeling threatened by black people consciously, subconsciously. I know you talked about how sometimes white people, and even a lot of black people, they respond to black person within a matter of seconds as though they're responding to a snake, you know, or something that could be life threatening. Do you bring up the work of Dr. Frances Cress Welsing and her theory of white genetic annihilation as a possible root of this fear?
Oh, yeah, sometimes. I don't do it all the time, but I was just in Baltimore. I was in St. Louis, having spent time in Ferguson and with some of the kids from Mike Brown's high school, Normandy High in St. Louis, and asking the question about, you know, on both ends. Someone asked me about what I thought about Frances Cress Welsing. I told exactly what I thought, because... the psychodynamic approach of fear and threat is that it's very primitive, that, you know, which is why some people, and this may be your view when you think about it's intentional or it's still literacy and knowledgeable when somebody is exacting power on another person. I just think of it as a psychologist, that sometimes people are shocked by how primitively they think a snake is in front of them when it's a 6-year-old boy. And I think that kind of dissociation and that kind of threat, Frances Cress Welsing helps to describe. And I would say that the fear that I might be annihilated, or that I find a 5-year-old boy, black boy, as a threat to my existence, or a 10-year-old black boy, or Tamir Rice as a 12-year-old boy, as a threat to me, that I have to shoot him in less than 10 seconds. I think she explains that. So I use that as an example there. But I've been talking about this threat as well from other angles, including Cress Welsing, but not only Cress Welsing. There's research now that I think helps to say that too.
What is some of the other research that helps confirm this threat response that white people have to black people in particular?
Oh, easily. The work of Philip Goff out of UCLA, where he looks at 10-year-old boys, black boys and 10-year-old white boys. And he asks a group of undergraduate white females, and he also asks a group of police officers to judge when they have a little bit of time, who's likely to be more innocent. And what when given the opportunity, both of these groups project the black boys as being less innocent and project the black boys as also being 4 years older. So somehow a 10-year-old boy looks 14, which puts him in a whole new category of child. And that it's almost a justification if he's older that I can see him as more menacing. And that work is just a year or two years old. There's been recent work where there's been associating five-year-old boys, black boys, and five-year-old white boys to images of guns and toys. And overwhelmingly, when you see a black boy's face, five-year-old face, connected to a toy, you assume it's a weapon and that they're going to use it in a way. And if you see it next to a white boy's face, it's seen as a toy rather than a weapon. And that's stuff that's happening in short periods of time. And then you have Walter Gilliam's research looking at preschool expulsion. And you have eye-tracking software of black teachers and white teachers. And where do they spend their time? Mostly gazing in the classroom of black and white children, boys and girls. We can track not only how often they are watching the black boys, but exactly when they are doing so in a picture. So that we don't have to question, do the boys get watched more than the black boys get watched more than other kids? And the question you might want to ask, how do the kids feel about people watching them, targeting them, surveilling them in a classroom where you need your teacher to love you and care for you, not think you're about to do something to get a good education? So these are just a few. And the neuroscience work is, that you were quoting around snake or spider is also in the literature. So these are primitive responses. And it's not just white people, even though the studies have been doing this a lot with white people. We also can have those responses. And if I could add one more thing, the research also, there's some research that suggests if you're a black man and you've experienced racism, the effect on your well-being and life, how long you live on this planet, is affected by that racism. But it so happens that if you also are a black man that experienced racism, and you think of other black people as more inferior, you look down on them, you live less longer than any other group, or your life is threatened at even greater rates, and which says something about the effects of systemic racism, where you think other people who look like you are more inferior than you. You take a hit emotionally because of that, and those are the kind of things we're also interested in addressing.
Very important addendum there. Wow. Super, super important. I would just add that right there is the goal of the system of white supremacy, to, as Dr. Welsing stated all the time, sure, to annihilate black self-respect, to make sure that you have nothing but trashy and degrading images of black people so that you think terrible about yourself and other black people. She said that explicitly is one of the goals and has been for a long, long time in the system of white supremacy. Yes. What then? I guess I also wanted to make sure I asked as well, do you feel at times where you have to, lack of a better term, dilute the way that you talk about white supremacy, racism, if you know you're going to be speaking or writing for a white audience?
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay. I thought you went out. Partly, the way I think about people in general, and the older I get, the answer is absolutely no, I don't. And because I care less about what people are going to think about me, in a public sense, that's a matter of age. But also, I bug my mother all the time, who had to be dealing with people who were black, white, brown, migrant, native, who also thought of her strange. She coming from North Philly down to Southern Delaware, which is like Mississippi. So at some point, she just said, hey, I'm going to be who I am. And I write about in the book, we were singing all kinds of gospel that black people in Southern Delaware never heard of before. But we also were singing stuff from Broadway musicals and Stevie Wonder nobody had ever heard before, too. So sometimes you're going to stand out whether you like it or not. And so you either embrace that. But I do believe that everybody is human. I don't treat anybody less human, regardless of who they are, which means if I see you struggling with something, I'm going to try my best to help you work through it. And that is just also part of our legacy. So I want to give it to you in a way that I think is going to move you to another place. And I say this in the beginning of most of my talks is I used to be the kind of person to support my white colleagues to help that they get it in the first 5 or so years of my being an academic. And then I realized it didn't work because they didn't use the safety to take risks. So now I piss more people off. And I do it with a belief that I believe in you enough to challenge you, but you got to step up your game. And we can't wait for you if you can't step up your game. Our children depend on much more. So, I'm going to listen. And I'm going to treat everybody human. But we can't be shape-shifting ourselves because our children are dying.
Well said. Well said. I did want to point out that instance where you said kind of at the beginning of your career that you, I guess, were more supportive of your white colleagues. But then as you watched, you saw that from their position of white power, they did not use that power and safety to take risks to support working against racism, to support black people, black colleagues like yourself or black students, what have you. That to me would seem to be another illustration of black people being poorly informed about what it means to be white, racism, white supremacy. Mm-hmm. And I'm still learning. When I say we, I say me, Gus, you can put my name at the top of the list. I am not as informed as white people are about the subject of white supremacy. I am still learning. That's why I'm doing the program, so I can, you know, learn more and hopefully share with listeners as well. One more question I wanted to get in before you we let you enjoy the rest of your evening, unless our listeners have been, like, within the next 30 seconds, if you have a question for Dr. Stevenson, go ahead and get your hand up before we let him go. The number again, 641-715-3640, and the code 564-943-pound. Press *6. If you would like to participate, I agree. I think you've brought this point up a few times. Everybody, non-white people, also black people, we are all contaminated with white supremacist concepts and ideas. The way we think about other black people, the way we think about ourselves, absolutely, and that influences the way that we, you know, think and behave, treat other black people, other non-white people. You said at the beginning of the program you have two children, two sons. One 12, the other 26. You said you have one child who's African-American. You have one child that's African-American and Filipino. Is there any difference in how your children navigate, seeing that one of them having a Filipino parent? I don't know if skin complexion is noticeably different, or do they experience racism, mm-hmm. white supremacy differently on that basis?
My son, both of them, the oldest and the youngest, experienced rejection around their race in school at young ages. And, you know, you could argue that some people didn't catch that my oldest son was biracial. They just saw him as he was, you know, darker skinned, even though his hair is a little different. But he is, you know, a filmmaker and is becoming even more conscious about what he's seeing among his friends, and he's become more outspoken. I mean, you'd have to ask him about his experiences in that regard, but I saw them both going through stuff, and and their mothers both have been direct involvement around teaching them about their histories and making them exposed to their cultures. And so there was a lot of racial socialization they both got, and I think my oldest got even more around his Filipino family that we both supported. And because I think you know, knowing your heritage is still very important. So, but they both were thought of as black males in a larger society where, you know, people don't decide. They're very black and white sometimes about that. And in many respects, I do think he's had, my oldest has had also different experiences as he's gotten older. But you'd have to ask him about that.
Hmm. Is he doing films about racism or?
He's doing films about a lot of relationships, and he and his friends, all young men of color, have pulled together, and some other friends as well. They have their own business, and they've been doing video work for Nike and other places. They run Foot Action's website, and they're entrepreneurs and pulling together how they represent a demographic of young people that require a certain amount of particular type of advertising that appreciates what's going on in pop culture. So they're blogging. They're also commentary around music and politics and racism. But they're also, you know, talking about a lot of different things. So, you know, it's a different world than the one I grew up with. But I see him growing every day more as an activist around these issues.
Wow. Maybe you can send me an email back and check out the blog or, you know, some of the projects that they're working on to see see some of the things that they're doing.
Cool.
Outstanding. I will assume the listeners are satisfied. I didn't see a hand, so I'll assume you all got everything that you wanted to hear, at least for the moment, from Dr. Howard Stevenson, the book we've been discussing this evening, again, Promoting Racial Literacy in Schools, Differences That Make a Difference. You can check it out, available at Amazon.com. Really appreciate it, you coming to spend some time with us this evening. I know our listener who heard you when you went out to Missouri, he enjoyed you there. Hopefully he enjoyed hearing you again on the program this evening, and particularly getting your response about the conversation with your son about the murder of Trayvon Martin. It has been a pleasure, sir.
Thank you very much, Gus.
Yes, sir. Take care. Enjoy the rest of your evening, Dr. Stevenson.
Take care now.
Yes,
bye-bye.
Sir. Good evening. Context of White Supremacy. Again, our guest, Dr. Howard Stevenson, joining us live. Great having him on the program. One of our listeners, as I stated, in the Missouri area, suggested that we get him on the program. I think he heard him at a talk about some of the same issues that we discussed this evening. He gave two thumbs up, said we could get him on the program. I hope you're able to hear. He actually wrote in a question or two I think we were able to get on the broadcast. Again, we should be here tomorrow, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Pam will be joining us. This will be the first time that we've had her on the program for the 2017 year. We'll also be here on Thursday for Workplace Racism, normal time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. We'll be here also Friday, 7th book study session on Coretta Scott King's autobiography, My Life, My Love, My Legacy, this coming Friday, and the compensatory call-in on Saturday, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. Tune in. If you have questions, you can't find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Before I ask if folks have any comments they want to get in, what they heard from Dr. Stevenson, again, remind listeners, we are listener-supported counter-racist radio. Invest if you think the program is constructive. racism-notes.blogspot.com racism-notes.blogspot.com listener-supported counter-racist radio. When you hit the blog, PayPal button is in the top right corner. If you're not into PayPal, drop us an email and we will get you a physical mailing address. Huge thanks to all the folks who have invested, supported us 8+ years. I hope the program has been and continues to be worthy of your time and energy. You can also hit the wish list at Amazon.com under Gus T. Renegade. With that, I had such a chuckle that I have my notes. I just updated them within the last 2 days. I have extensive notes for our upcoming broadcast on metaphors, and it'll be sound clips from programs that we've done over the years where we've just had really incredible metaphors pop up and be incorporated for the way that we discuss racism. I think this broadcast will be included. The use of metaphors, once again, and again, why we on the Saturday program, why I ask repeatedly, weekly, that people not use metaphors, because it can just get very confusing. And a lot of times the metaphors end up taking the place of there being accurate facts, definitions, explanations of what racism is, how it works. It'll just be a lot of metaphors, and a lot of times it'll just be rhetoric that appeals to emotion and feelings as opposed to logic. And that's what we need, accurate logic. That's what solves problems. I also, with Raisin in the Sun, I don't know if people have seen that. That's an older movie, play, whatever you want to call it. But again, it gets redone. They've done it so many times. I am of the opinion, when Dr. Welsing, she was on this program and she talked about how images of black pathology, where black people are down and out and, you know, don't have a biscuit between five of them and, you know, are out fighting rats in the street for a dime. Those types of films, if you want to think of Good Times or Porgy and Bess, which just came up in Mrs. King's autobiography. Raisin in the Sun is just like that. Black family, I think it's like, it's about six, seven people living in one ratty, broke down slum apartment in Chicago. Pam will be here tomorrow. And they get money, insurance money, after the death of the grandfather. And then the drunkard black father, played by Sidney Poitier, Cowbell, squanders all the money. They're going to open up a liquor store. I think that's what it was. It was like a bar or a liquor store or some, you know, whatever establishment. And they're going to do this, and a black person steals all their money, and so they're broke. And they were going to use that money to buy a house in the white part of Chicago. And white people came, a nice white person in a suit came and said, you know, hey, we would prefer if you all don't move to our area, and we will pay you, you know, like double the value of the house to not move here, which was a common thing that was done in this time period. And they say, no. We're not going to do it. We're going to go ahead and move. And even after they get robbed of all their money, they still decide that they're going to go ahead and move and just get, you know, extra jobs and go move. And that's how it ends. That's the happy ending to this story. I can totally understand why racists would support and love, adore this movie. It's just been redone so many times. They have a version where Ozzie Davis is the main character. As I said, they have another version where P. Diddy is the main character. They just do it over and over and over. They probably have, you know, versions where Gus T. Renegade was in it, and I just forgot about it. But it's very common, and I can understand why that just stood out to me even more, to have someone advocate, you know, that this is an example of counter-racist work, advocating to do a production of Raisin in the Sun. Wow. And the mention, I think it is profound, given Dr. Eddie Moore. You can go back and listen. He did two historic broadcasts on this program back in 2009. It's one of the first 20 programs that we did. The infamous Soothing Lotion sound clip. But it is incredible for him, the comment he made about Soothing Lotion, for him now to be co-authoring a book explaining what white women need to know, as though they're ignorant about some aspect of racism when they go in the classroom. That, I mean, again, I can only say someone is incorrect. Much of the information about racism, white supremacy, is false. And a part of your job as a counter-racist is to ascertain what is true. At the end of the day, I am submitting that when many people, most of the people, when they talk about this issue, when they say that white people are ignorant about racism, that is false. And that is one of the major reasons we have not made more progress in solving this problem. That all of that talk that black people are the experts on racism, that is false. And that is anyone promoting that is promoting, if it's a white person, I just assume that they're deliberately practicing white supremacy, promoting that line of thinking. Many non-white people, we are confused about racism. I think that was one thing, at least Dr. Stevenson, where we agreed on, where he said there were times where he himself had made some errors, where he did not have a correct understanding of this problem. I'm in the same boat, another metaphor. But that is one thing I at minimum hope people who listen to this program can come to a logical conclusion on. It is impossible, totally impossible and downright absurd for anyone to suggest 2017 system of white supremacy, that white people are ignorant, that we need to write them a book so that they will stop treating us like niggers. That is absurd. I will pause there. Folks that dialed in, did folks have a question, comment on what they heard? We have mom in Michigan, retired firefighter. If you all had commentary, I know you all got to ask questions based on what you heard from Dr. Stevenson. Feel free.
Yes, sir. And I need someone to correct me if I'm not accurate. What I heard, for the most part, over the important question on if, in terms of racism, white supremacy, who is more knowledgeable about this, the system of racism, white supremacy, white people or their victims? He kept using the explanation of ultimately when non-white people rise up intellectually, white people just impose direct violence. Well, I'm saying even in the standpoint of direct violence, there for so few people to be able to dominate violently the vast majority of people, it had to be some sort of awareness on how to accomplish that, as opposed to just brute force, quote unquote, because there's just too many people to be able to harm. And on a daily basis, you have to have some other process and procedures. I was going to ask him if a person is deceitful and cunning, what can that also be identified as being smart? You know, I mean, I don't know. He kept going there. Am I incorrect, he passed part of my questioning off to you?
Yeah, I think he did say, you know, it might be better for me to answer that one. I was just going to redirect back to you since you asked the question to him. I thought you were very explicit about that.
Right, because I was going to ask you what did you understand about that? I didn't understand that. Maybe he got tired of dealing with the subject matter. But I would say, because I've done that, other than the lady caller who does it, which I think is very important. I do that in my personal walks, and non-white people, in my opinion, horribly fail, in my opinion, that question. I mean, I've heard Mr. Fuller give an explanation to that and saying it's kind of hurtful and embarrassing to non-white people of our situation. So we're looking to feel good, and that don't make us feel good. That's for sure. That particular understanding, reality, in my opinion, is not something to feel good over, that we are not aware of. As long as we've been subject to it, we're not aware of what it is and how it works. And I'll let somebody else chime in on what they have to say about the interview. Thank you.
For sure. Any of the other folks have commentary they wanted to share, what they heard from Dr. Spencer, or folks satisfied?
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Well, I thought it was an interesting interview and dialogue. I think that the more he just talked and answered questions, it just constantly becomes more clear to me how confused non-white people are as opposed to white people. I appreciate just the question and answer process, because the more I'm asking questions and allowing someone to answer and then ask them why, it gives me a better understanding of just really how confused non-white people are. I think in the interview he did say that he doesn't think, and I could be incorrect, but he did say he doesn't think that racism is going to end. And so did he say that, or am I incorrect? And did he say something like that?
I thought he said something very close to that, that racism wasn't going to end, or that at minimum it was going to be here for a very long time. It sounded like he might have said several variations of that, but I think at one point he did say explicitly that racism was not going to end.
And so with that being the case, if that's how he's looking at it, then what's the whole point of his work? And so I kind of wanted to ask that question, like, what's the purpose of this work if you don't see an end to this? Are we just trying to... I just didn't understand that. So I thought that was an interesting response. And I, again, just appreciate the question and answer process. I'm still learning, and I appreciate this program. I'll mute my line.
Yeah, I was going to... at that, he moved on to something else, but when he said that, buddy, if you don't think the problem of racism can be solved, there is no need to do any lectures. There's no need to write books. There's no need to do any radio programs, films, nothing, in my opinion. And I will tell you, Gus T, if I ever get to the point where I think, oh yeah, this is a done deal, this problem cannot be solved, talking about the system of white supremacy, I will be done. We will not, because I mean, that's a total waste of time. Why would I do this broadcast if it's just, oh yeah, we're just here commenting about something that cannot be corrected, but we're just gonna talk about it. That's silly. I would just say, do the best you can to try to get the most comfortable position that you can on the plantation. That would be my suggestion, and that's what I would go about doing, not this broadcast. But the person who called in, let's see, last four digits, 2812. Did you have commentary?
Oh, hey, Gus. I didn't get a chance to. I called in a little late, and I didn't want to interrupt the broadcast, but I think I wanted to ask him specifically. There was a white female that was on your show, the broadcast, maybe 2 weeks ago. That was from South Africa, and I remember her specifically during the broadcast saying, "Let's all be honest. You know, academics don't do anything, or we don't solve any problems." And I wanted to kind of ask him, did he agree with that? And not necessarily they don't solve problems, but what is the purpose of these white people writing all these books and doing all these lectures if they're not changing their behavior, similar to what everybody else just said? And then it almost seems as now that this whole, it's almost like a trend that there are a lot of people that are writing books, and this is a good way to make money. But I don't see anybody specifically classified as white changing any behavior or even identifying in any of these works or any of this academia, like who's doing all this systematic racism. Like everybody's pointing it out, but we can never even get a name of who's doing it. So those are just the questions I wanted to ask him if he had any comments about that. And that's all. But I got a chance to listen to the end of it, and it seemed like it was pretty constructive. And I agree with everybody else. Asking questions, you kind of see who's confused the most, and it's clearly non-white people. So that's it.
Appreciate that. If the person who saw Dr. Stevenson in Missouri, if they are listening, if you're able to chime in live, that would be cool, because I think when Dr. Stevenson said he was asked about Dr. Welsing, That was our Cows listener who asked him about Dr. Welsing, because he emailed me when he suggested Dr. Stevenson, and he said that he asked him about Dr. Welsing's definition of white supremacy, and I think he said he agreed for the most part. I think he might have had one caveat, and then he said he had another question as well, which he did not get to ask. But yeah, that's why I said go to these events. You can ask what you can ask. What do you think of Dr. Welsing's work? What do you think of Mr. Fuller's work? Or have your own? You know, this is my definition for racism. What do you think? You can go and ask questions. That can have a big impact as well. One thing that I also thought was significant, I thought, and this is a pattern I've noted, this is not anything peculiar to Dr. Stevenson, but an unwillingness to name white people specifically, like it just gets addressed in a very general sense, harm happening to black people, but it's not consistently not stating racists. White people. It's just this harm happens in some way. I thought that was consistent throughout, and it'll be that in conjunction with black people can be racist. I think Thomas in New York asked that non-white people can be racist, and consistently going into the ways that white non-white people, black people, support, uphold racism, white supremacy. I'm not saying that that's false. Yes, absolutely, non-white people have been contaminated with racist concepts, and we do things to support, uphold, maintain racism, white supremacy. All of us, Gus T. Renegade especially. But that is secondary. That is from a position of submission and domination. We are subordinate to racist man, racist woman, racist child. They are most to blame. And he had said that a few times in his writing and in lectures, interviews that he gave, where he was saying that this was not about blaming white people, which is exactly verbatim what Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., founder of the White Privilege Conference, states. It was almost like a cliche in the trailers and promos and advertisements of the White Privilege Conference, that we're not about beating up on white people. We're not about beating up on white people. We're not about beating up on white people, even though on this program, 2010, in a veiled manner, he threatened to punch Gus T. in the nose. But the White Privilege Conference is not about beating up on racist man, racist woman, racist. I just think that is a standard way that racism is talked about. And I think that right there says a lot about the fear of talking about addressing racism, white supremacy. Honestly, what you're allowed to say, what you're not allowed to say. I'll hush there. The person that dialed in, last four digits, 7337, 7337. Did you have commentary?
Yes. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard? Okay. Hey, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers. I'm the caller from Missouri who actually recommended the guest. And I do apologize because I missed the entire interview. I had activities with the kids, karate, and some other things. So I was just kind of getting in late and getting everything situated. And just listening to the commentary, I mean, I kind of agree with the callers, basically what they were saying. Because when I went to the presentation, I noticed that, you know, first of all, there was a lot of white people there. And I assumed that they were, I guess, educators or people in academia, I guess, trying to figure out, you know, racial literacy or whatever. And, you know, he just kept saying, like, you know, it's not about placing blame. And he said that like two or three times. And, you know, I was just kind of sitting there like, well, how, I mean, you know, is it really constructive not to place blame where it actually belongs? And I did want to ask him that question, but I didn't get a chance to get to it. And as far as the Dr. Francis Quest question that I asked him, he did agree with the definition. However, he did say that he wasn't too sure about the genetic annihilation part. So he'd be interested. I don't know if you got a chance to ask him that, Gus, but I'm definitely going to go back to the archives and listen and see how the interview went, because I did have a few, you know, a few other questions that I wanted to ask and see exactly what was the purpose of writing a book. Because I heard someone say that he said he don't think racism is going anywhere. So, you know, that leads to the next question, like, what is the purpose of you actually doing this work. And that's it. I'll be on my line.
Right on. Thank you kindly for being able to dial in. And we did. I did ask him about Dr. Welsing's theory of white genetic annihilation. I thought he said he did agree with that component of it, that that was what was motivating white fear of black people. I think he said that explicitly. So that will be, I don't know, it'll be interesting once you're able to go back, if you listen to the archives, to hear his response, to compare that to what he said when you asked him the question live in person. I did add, that was why I asked him that question towards the end about, does he mitigate or change the way that he talks about racism, white supremacy, based on how white people will respond to his work? And he said no, now, because he's older. And I got the impression that he was watching or mindful about the things that he was saying, to make sure that I'm not saying anything too incendiary that might rile up white folks, because I get that impression from a lot of non-white people who speak about racism. That's the result of terrorism. You know, a lot of non-white people have gotten in a lot of trouble and included being killed as a result of just speaking about racism. So I think that happens to a lot of us. But that was the impression that I got. Someone who is has to be mindful of what they say, that white people could do some damage depending on what they say and how they talk about this problem. Other folks have commentary? Anything else they wanted to add?
Yes, I was just going to say Dr. Welsing herself basically was punished for her writings. And that was primarily in an indirect sense, non-white people used to get at her to so she can lose her tenure on it. So I think what you had to say on that to the guests was accurate, and I'm pretty sure that he has to tone down some of his rhetoric and or writings in that way. The last thing that I had to say is the central figure of why he was on the being interviewed in the first place. The book that he read, if we are so intelligent and so sharp on racism, white supremacy, it would be no need for him to write the book. And would I be correct on saying that?
That's my view.
I mean, it wouldn't make no sense if we were intellectually, I forgot what the theme of it was. What was the theme of it?
Racially literate.
Yeah, if we were racially literate, and the only form of racial literacy in my mind that counts would be the understanding of racism, white supremacy, and I mean, if we were more aware of it than the people who victimize us, then I wouldn't see any need for the book. That's just I think I'm being logical.
I concur that, and again, you know, we have people on this program over the year, even before this program existed, but when I would just talk to non-white people and they would say, you know, what are you using this term white supremacy for? They're not supreme. Or in Mr. Fuller's code book, when they would say, you know, where he says racists are the smartest people in the universe, like, that is absurd. I'm not going to read anymore. They're not. We've had tons of those conversations. Over the years, all I can conclude that is an emotional response that makes us feel bad to think that, you know, racists are smarter than us. Again, I go by the logic. It would be the same thing if we were playing basketball. Again, to use the metaphor, if we were playing basketball and I lose to you every time. Now, I might not like admitting, yes, you are better than me at basketball. I might not like admitting that. But that is the truth. It's been my experience. We don't have a problem, even when we don't like it, even when it's painful, acknowledging truth in other aspects. The team that we wanted to win, they lose. Oh, well, we just accept that. We don't lie about it. I think we should use the same logic and the same honesty when making an evaluation of racism, white supremacy. And a lot of this is just because so many people lie about this all the time. You hear all the time that, you know, black people are the experts. You know, you hear white people say, oh, yeah, black people taught me everything. James Baldwin and Frantz Fanon taught me everything I need to know about racism, that, you know, we believe that and we want to feel good to think, oh, yeah, I'm an expert on racism. Absolutely. I know everything to know about it. False. The experts on racism are all white. If you are a victim of racism, white supremacy, you don't know nearly enough about racism. And that is the logical step to take. That puts you in a learning mode. And you can feel bad about it. Great. I remember Mr. Fuller discussing this explicitly on the program. And he said, absolutely, I feel bad about it. I feel bad about it. And that motivates me to go out and work to solve this problem because I feel bad about it. You should feel bad about it because this is a horrible situation. This is something that is worthy of feeling bad about. Absolutely. Anything else folks need to get in?
That has to be the biggest, I'm about to use a metaphor, biggest hurdle is our inability to accept that, I think. If it's not the biggest, this is the top three, to be able to accept that. I myself personally went through a period of time where that was hard to accept. But I think from really having some self-examination and being honest, I learned to accept that reality. And know, first and foremost, that's not non-white people's fault, that we have been rendered in the kind of a mental position that we've been in. And Mr. Fuller said that it's not your fault if you're not in control of it. It's only your fault if you have the information and you still don't try to improve or work against something that you are subject to. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Thomas in New York, did you have... I can hear you as well, so I just want to nab Thomas in New York. I think he did get a few questions in. Are you there, sir?
Yes, I am. Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Good evening again. My phone died on me, so I had to let it charge up for a second and call back in. Just an interesting dialogue, and I just think it's very important that is... Black parents, attempted parents, that we teach our children about racism, about every aspect of the system. At least give them the general knowledge that the system exists. The other day, I was at Target, and I took my daughter with me because I wanted someone to push the cart for me. And on the way leaving the Target, across the street, I go to the Target in the Bronx, real close to Yankee Stadium, and across the street, when they built the stadium, they built this park. Now, majority of the people that live in the Bronx are non-white, and most people that use this park is non-white. However, in this park, they built a tennis court, and even put a dome around it so they could play tennis indoors. And the only people that can use the tennis courts are people who pay dues. So, of course, everyone who plays tennis over there are white. And as we were walking, pushing the cart back over into Harlem, one of the white boys, the ball went over the fence. And he came over to the fence and he was screaming across the street to us. We're all the way across the street. This is like a six-lane street with the island in the middle. I mean, the ball is right there on the sidewalk, by where he's at. He's asking my daughter, can she run across the street and throw the ball over the fence? So she kind of looks at me for permission. I tell her, no, don't help white people, no. So she, as we're walking away, and she didn't get the ball. And we crossed the street and over by the tennis court and walking further away from it. just, you know, she's telling me, oh, here you go with your racism. And you're always telling, you know, and that wasn't right. You could have threw the guy a ball. I said, you know what he said about you as soon as he walked away and didn't get his ball? He said, nigger. She said, oh, no, he didn't. And then just as I say that, he comes out to get the ball, and guess what he says? Niggers. So it was very important. She says, oh, how did you know he was going to say that? You know, so it's very important that we teach our kids very young that this is what they should be expecting from these people. They're not going to change, and that's how we should be dealing with them. The gentleman who you had on, he was making, in my opinion, a lot of excuses for white people, trying to find good in them and trying to find a good one, you know, give you a story about this one teacher. It's just not logical. And I'll be honest, thank you.
Wow, what an anecdote. That is brilliant, outstanding counter-racist parenting to go ahead and get that in. That is just outstanding. I can't believe that happened to be able to predict and then bang. And you can do that consistently. You can go ahead and just be confident that, hey, white people are going to practice the religion of white supremacy. Have to. And I mean, that is, you talk about a teachable moment. I'm sure that's going to stick in her mind for years. She's going to remember that moment. And I mean, wow, that might be I'll be interested to see how many more times you have to have a conversation with her about helping white people after that incident. Like, wow. great A-plus effort, Thomas in New York. The other male caller who spoke up simultaneously, did you have a commentary you were going to share as well?
Oh, I missed the questions in the beginning because I couldn't get on. But I wanted to ask if I looked at his reviews on his book. The book that is only 7 reviews on Amazon, and I'm interested in education, you know, anything that has to do with school systems and black people. I wanted to know, did anybody get a chance to ask him about this? I guess about the title of the book, racial inequality. About it's been. Statistics show that 65%, it might be a little higher, but 65-70% of the teachers in America are white females or white in general. So has anybody asked him about, you know, well, don't you think that white people have something to do with any of this? And I would just be curious about his response. And the reason why I said that is because one of the reviews that's on Amazon specifically states that this is a must read. It's a must read for white educators everywhere. And I've just been listening to this program a lot every day for the past 2 years. And when white people are excited about a book, the antennas go up. And that would just be one question that I would have for him, since the majority of educators in America are white and specifically females, you know, who is the problem? And that's all I wanted to say. I wasn't sure if anybody even got a chance to address that. That's all.
I asked him specifically about white women teachers being, as you said, a super majority of public school teachers, and he gave his response to that, which still included, you know, terms incompetence and ignorance. But we did touch on that in the exchange.
Oh, okay.
And he
brought up the one white teacher.
Right. White female teacher who supported him doing his, when he was in high school, them doing Raisin in the Sun. I guess they would typically only do these one of two plays that were white plays, and they switched and did Lorraine Hansberry's Raisin in the Sun, which is a cowbell. I guess it depends on how much you know about Lorraine Hansberry, who Malcolm X frequently criticized for explicit reasons. But which I think is in his autobiography, unless I'm mistaken. But he mentioned this white female teacher, I guess, advocating. And interestingly, he said that she put her career in jeopardy. And when I asked explicitly, I said, oh, wow, you know, what happened with her career? He said, oh, well, nothing. I was just thinking of other times for white. And I mean, that's what I mean, where... It is absurd when we're talking about this, where not only are we not directly naming white people as the culprits, and then we got to say constantly, this is not about blaming white people. This is not about beating up on white people. And then we got to look for anomalies. We got to find one white person that maybe popped up every 500 years who didn't call us a nigger maybe got us a cup of tea and a sandwich. And it's, oh my gosh, this is the great, let's talk. We got to spend the next 5 years talking about John Brown and the next 10 years talking about Jane Elliott. It's like, are you serious? Are you and then as though this white person suffered, because that's a constant theme too, that these white people suffered. They were almost like Jesus. We heard some of that Coretta Scott King. That's the way that she talked about John F. Kennedy and his brother, Robert Kennedy. When you really investigate, there was not even any suffering. They were just chilling. Like, yeah, I'll stop there. Didn't folks have anything else they wanted to add?
One more thing. Gus, he was asked the sex with white people question. And I thought it was interesting on how he responded to it. He said he didn't, he wasn't in a sexual relationship, or I guess I think he said he never was one. But he said, he said that implied that it wasn't an incorrect activity if non-white people have sex with white people. And he also, in a kind of like a sarcastic way, stated that he thought the question was interesting, as though it's something that is not supposed to be asked. And I thought that was interesting.
Y'all asked my question, and I was shocked because I thought that, you know, my answer would be a flat-out no. But he was, well, not currently, and then he, well, never was either. So I was like, strange. But I asked the question because, to me, he had a very high level of white validation. And that generally comes from people who have a white parent or have been involved with white people in a sexual way. So that's why I asked that question.
Yeah, I understand, but he did state without being prompted to do so, he did state that he didn't think it was incorrect for non-white people to be in a sexual relationship with white people under the system of racist white supremacy. Nobody prompted him to say it. He said it on his own. So that really tells me something. Whole part about himself personally, and therefore on some of the answers that he was giving during the interview. Excuse me.
And also, when I asked him if there's white people who are not racist, he wouldn't say no. But then he diverted it and went into talking about things that black people did to black people, which is another trend that I, noticed from black guests and white guests. When you try to talk about racism, they start talking about black people, stuff that black people did. It never gets directly to that question.
Black on black crime. Yes, very, very common. Even historic. That's, I'm going to start saying that when they start saying that black people sold black people into slavery. Yes, the transcontinental black on black crime. Yes, yes, yes. Back to white people. Did any other commentary folks wanted to make sure they got in? Folks satisfied? Anything else?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay. This is the caller from Missouri that attended the presentation. Just one more comment that I wanted to make, because when I went to the presentation that Dr. Stevens had, he specifically said at the beginning that, people need to be explicit when you talk about race, and, you want to make people uncomfortable and so on and so forth. But he failed to mention the word racism or even white supremacy. I wasn't so much expecting a white supremacy, but if you are doing a presentation on racial literacy, I thought racism would come up, at some point in the presentation. And it didn't come up, and I asked him about that, why he didn't mention it, because he had played a, an audio tape of him talking to his son after the Trayvon Martin incident. And when he was speaking to his son, he actually did mention racism as the cause of,
you know, why I guess Zimmerman had killed Trayvon and, you know, so on. But I just thought it was interesting that he didn't, you know, didn't mention racism during this whole presentation. So, you know, I was kind of underwhelmed with the whole presentation, and I was going to bother a little bit. I'm like, I don't see it being too constructive, because I thought that he was kind of like just tiptoeing, you know, around the presentation because it was majority white. So I think he may have switched it up. But then when I asked him the question, the Dr. Francis question about the definition of racism, white supremacy, after he started going into explaining, you know, what he thought about the definition and all that, then after a few more questions, he started to use racism and white supremacy as a structure. And, you know, he just started using it after the fact. So I just thought that was kind of interesting. But I'm kind of with the other caller that said about the book, you know, white people are excited about it. You know, that raises an eyebrow. So I was going to purchase the book even after this interview, but I think I may pass on it, you know, just because I don't think it's that, it's probably not too constructive for me, but I'll mute my line. Thanks again, Gus.
Yes, sir. Well, I'm a big advocate of talking to white people. You certainly can learn things. Dr. Stevenson, I greatly appreciate his commentary about the significance, the critical importance of talking to your children or just younger, not black people, black children about racism. Absolutely agree with that. Hope people take that to heart. but yeah, I really, the importance in my view is talking to the experts on this topic. That would be racist man, racist woman, racist child. That's why I always look forward to talking to white people about these issues and appreciate white guest suggestions. Absolutely. Any other commentary folks need to get in? Anything else? Everybody satisfied? Nothing else they wanted to share?
Oh, yeah, Gus, did you get my email about hip-hop?
Let's see. Tracking back to my email, someone just posted on my Facebook Facebook page that there's some contaminated waste site very close to Seattle. I am alarmed. I'm going to make sure I read some of the details on that. Whites generally do a better job of not allowing that sort of thing to happen here, since they don't have a whole lot of black people. Let's see.
Since you're in Seattle and a firefighter and got the guy, gentleman in Missouri, did the rape in Harlem make the news out there?
I haven't heard about it. I have not checked the Seattle Times today, so it might be there, but I have not heard about it.
A white female was raped 3 o'clock in the morning and beat up pretty brutally by a black male. The white female, she was from Germany, and she had Airbnb'd someone's apartment, which I just don't understand why you would want to go live in someone's apartment at home. But she was here for a couple of days, and this guy saw her walking down the street, and I mean, he hit her a few times, knocked out all her teeth, and ripped off her clothes and raped her. And I mean, the police presence around here has been multiplied, quadrupled in the last 2-3 days, and it's been all they talked about on the news. And I just thought it might have went global or national, being that under the context and the conditions of the rape, and you know, just generally like what they like to promote.
I'm checking the Seattle Times right now, and I don't see it mentioned there. I would have to check some of the other news outlets as the day continues, just because it's still pretty early out here, early in the evening. So I'll check the local news this evening to see if it comes up. But yeah, this is the first that I've heard of it. I'm sure it will get more attention as the week continues. The email, yes, I just was able to check the email on the hip-hop music link. Drugs and music, excuse me.
Yeah, I want to do a little talking about that on the Saturday show. I think it'll be some of the research I found just from reading that article and then doing more research on my own. I think people will find it quite compelling.
I see. Right on. I will post it on Facebook so folks can judge for themselves where they do kind of a genre breakdown of which genres mention music genres mention drugs the most, which you can check out. They have some pretty interesting animated graphics to go along with all this, but it's interesting. I'll post it on the Facebook page, and Thomas says that he will have a report prepared for Saturday, at least an audio report prepared for Saturday, to give a few extra comments on this. Did any other folks have commentary they need to get in? Anything else? Everyone satisfied? I will assume everyone is good. Again, we'll be here tomorrow. Pam returns, first time in the 2017 calendar year. Will be great to have her back on the program. Really looking forward to getting some of her commentary on a myriad of subject matters, but it should be 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. You can visit her blog, racismws.com, and the books Black Love is a Revolutionary Act, Trojan Horse, Death of a Dark Nation, The Interracial Con Game, and The Beauty Con Game. But she'll be here tomorrow evening, and then we'll also be here for Workplace Racism on Thursday. If you have questions, guest suggestions, problems, you can't find something in the archives, gripes, just drop an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. Thanks to all the folks who dialed in. Hope it was worthy of your Tuesday evening. Out here, it is gorgeous. I've been bragging about the warming weather now that the coldest winter in 30 years is behind us. I was able to enjoy some sunshine and to sit at the window and broadcast and enjoy a lovely, spring evening in the Pacific Northwest. So folks on the West Coast, at least, warm enough you can still go outside, get some warm weather, get some exercise in. I encourage folks definitely take advantage and be more active. Just remain codified. Just because the weather is warm does not mean racists take a vacation from terrorizing black people. Particularly, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. There's too much evidence that non-white people intoxicated, being out and about, just become easier to terrorize and victimize when you're not alert about your surroundings. And frequently that'll be justification for racism. Oh, you look like you were stumbling, or didn't seem like you had your equilibrium, or whatever other justification that they, you know, need to ask you a bunch of questions or tase you or even take your life. So just be mindful of that. Being sober would be the best route. If you got to consume, get to one spot and stay there. You do not want to be out and about. Very easy, you could end up being Jordan Edwards or in a situation where you're intoxicated, and now you have to use words to make sure that you can exit the situation with your life. Just keep all that in mind as you have fun in the summer or soon to be summertime. That's it. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in. Actually, since we had a little bit of extra time, we're going to actually include some of the audio, not the full audio, but just a few minutes of the exchange that Dr. Eddie Moore Jr. had on his first visit to the cows 8 years ago, way, way back in 2000. 9 when he was on the program, Dr. Eddie Moore Jr., we were discussing tragic arrangements, sexual intercourse, and why they are incorrect between white people and non-white people under the system of white supremacy. This is just a short segment for newer listeners who may not have heard some of Dr. Moore's commentary from previous visits to the cows.
I think for me, I don't think someone who argues for segregated relationships, interracial or interpersonal kinds of relationships, can accomplish justice for all. I don't know if it's venom or suspicion or resistance or whatever it is that is a part of that. I mean, you can't accomplish justice in that framework. I don't think. At least I'll have to think more about that. But that's what I'm thinking right now, is how can you accomplish justice as a person who believes that people should only be in sexual relationships with the people that they identify. I don't even know if that's what you're saying. Are you saying I guess I kind of put words in your mouth. I don't know if you're saying that non-white folks can have interrelations with non-white folks. We just can't have them or shouldn't have them or can't accomplish what we need to accomplish if we have them with just white folks.
What I'm saying, and it's actually, this is written on my show page, under the system of racism, white supremacy, I do not encourage, condone, or participate in sexual relationships between white people and non-white people. That is exactly, precisely what I'm saying, and I'm saying the reason is because it is incorrect. And I guess since you said you don't know if a person can achieve or establish justice with that point of view, the evidence shows non-white people have not been able to replace white supremacy with justice and engage in sexual intercourse with white people. The evidence shows we have not been able to do it the other way. I'm unaware of non-white people ever taking a stance that this behavior is incorrect, and we will not engage in sexual intercourse with white people as long as the system of white supremacy exists. I'm suggesting perhaps we should try it another way.
Yeah, I think that's not a strategy or an option that shouldn't be on the table and should be up for a discussion. And I think in the 21st century, I'm all up for having different options on the table. So I'll definitely have to myself give that some thought. But are you saying that you have seen justice accomplished by non-white people who have only had relationships with non-white people?
Oh, I have not seen justice at all. All I have seen is a system of white supremacy, a system of injustice. I'm not saying that if non-white people today said worldwide we're not having sex with white people as long as the system of white supremacy exists, it might not produce justice. It might not produce anything. But what I am saying is that I have seen an incredible amount of evidence that when non-white people engage in sexual intercourse with white people, it always has destructive and adverse impacts on that non-white person's ability to think honestly about racism, white supremacy, and particularly to be suspicious and critical of white people under the system of white supremacy. That is what I have observed every time. It becomes a very personal attachment that non-white people have to white people. They have a white person that they can identify with and that they have to tell themselves, this person cannot be a racist. And once you've done that for one white person, now there got to be passes for other white people. That's what I have observed consistently, and that needs to come to a halt. In my view, I could be incorrect, but
yeah, I would say as a case point that you are incorrect. For me, I think not only have I been able to continue the work that I'm doing, but I think that actually my level of scrutiny and criticism has risen because of those kinds of experiences have given me a new insight, a new place and new spaces that has helped me to uncover even more reasons to raise the level of suspicion. So, and I think that those non-white side that experience that greater level of scrutiny puts them in a position of greater discomfort and a need for greater awareness, because you can't continue it if my level of scrutiny is rising and your level of comfort is subsiding. I mean, you experience a greater level of discomfort and have to bring a greater level of consciousness in order for there to be, I think, a healthy existence. At least my experience, that's my scenario. But I mean, mine may just be one, you know, fluke kind of situation, and it may be, and I'm not unwilling to critically look at this. It may be just a personal desire on my part to find a, you know, kind of soothing lotion so it doesn't feel so painful what it is that you're saying. So I'm not unwilling to look at that, but I just think that I'm gonna give that some thought.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning.
Mm-hmm.
Even my conditioning has been conditioned.